Okay, at this time, I want to introduce our main speaker for the night, and that's Bill.
Hi there, folks. I'm Bill Morton, and I am an alcoholic. How would I start this? I'm not your run-of-the-mill alcoholic, for one thing. I only had one addiction, and that was alcohol. Well, maybe donuts. That's pretty nip and tuck there, I think. Just as an example, I remember years and years back, I was visiting with someone, and we went to a donut shop before they went home and had a couple of donuts, and that was just like taking the cork out of the bottle for me. So I thought, well, I better take a couple home with me. A dozen is cheaper than buying them two at a time. So I got the dozen to last me a week, and 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm looking through the bottom of the bag. There's no donuts left. There may as well have been a bottle. But if that's an addiction, I had it. Yeah. But I never ever got into drugs of any kind. I was strictly alcohol. So that's where I stand. My sobriety date is December 4th, 1977, and today is December 6th, so I just passed 37 years. This is about the third time I've spoke to this group. And the first time, you're back at the old place, the first time I showed up, nobody was there. Meeting had been canceled, nobody told the person getting the speakers or me. So she rebooked me for a few weeks later. The third time I got there, and it was right on my birthday, right on December 4th. So I said, my sobriety date's December 4th, 1977, and nobody even blinked. Nobody in that room knew what the date was, for God's sake. That's my experience speaking here. I'm 83 years old. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 46, and if my calculations are right, I had 30 years when my head wasn't developing. I had 7 years I spent here. You'll hear about that in a few minutes, that I never did anything. So that's 37, say 40 years. I'm really only 43 years old. And I look at myself in the mirror in the morning and think, no, my gosh, I guess he is 83. And some days it looks like 93. That's the way I stand right now. Enough of this nonsense. I was born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. When I was 4 years old, my father, who worked for the railway, got transferred. He got promoted and transferred 2,000 miles east of there, to the north shore of Lake Superior, for American people, about 200 miles up Lake Superior from Duluth, Minnesota. So that was where I grew up, went to school, and left at the age of 19. I had my first, my parents didn't drink, to speak of. My dad would have a beer when he came home from work, not every day. He'd buy a bottle of scotch one Christmas, and there'd be some of it left by the next Christmas. And so that was the amount of drinking that went on in our house. My mother would have a little touch of liqueur once in a while, but she wasn't fussy about that. My father had a brother and a sister who I realize now were alcoholics. That was the alcoholism in my family, none on my mother's side that I know of. So I did not grow up in an alcoholic climate, but my first brush with alcohol. And my parents didn't socialize very much. They weren't out very often. And one Saturday night, they went to visit some friends, and I was sitting there. It was back when you listened to the radio. You didn't look at the TV. There wasn't any. No TV. But I was listening to the radio, and said, I got thinking about that bottle of scotch my dad had in the closet and cupboard. And I went and got the bottle of scotch out, and from that day on, this was the way that I drank. I poured a glass full of it, didn't put anything in with it, and drank it. And I had another one after that. It wasn't just a little glass, it was a half-decent one. And I had another one after that. In other words, that was my initial drink, was alcoholically. I didn't want to quit, but I figured I'm going to be in an awful pile of crap here if he notices this gone. And I put the bottle back and went to bed, and all this various things happened that everybody knows about on that first drink. he never ever noticed that bottle had been tampered with. But I woke up the next morning, I was sick, I was guilty, I was afraid he was going to find out. All the symptoms that it would happen every time I overdrank from then on. I'm going to skip 2 years now to when I was 16, and I had a pass on the railway because my dad worked there, and I got on the train the day after school got out that summer, and I went to 2,000 miles west to where my grandmother lived. I was going to stay there, and a couple of days after I got there, I went downtown and got a job washing dishes at a resort in Lake Louise, Alberta, right in the Rockies. Lovely, lovely place. And I was 16, the youngest one there. The rest of the people were summer replacements were university students, and the manager, it was owned by a Swiss company, and all the executor managers and everything, the cook and all, they were Swiss people. And the only reason I mention this is that we had a party every couple of weeks, the staff did. And after one of those parties, maybe the second one, I was over my big sink full of greasy, god-awful looking breakfast pots and pans, trying to clean them and dry heave at the same time because I drank so much at the party the night before. And one of those Swiss guys come in and says to the cook, who was his brother, he says, "Did you see him last night?" And brother says, "No." He says, "I've never seen anybody that drunk that could still stand up." And that was the highlight of my teenage years. I was a half-decent athlete. I was a half-decent scholar. I engaged in lots of other stuff, but that was the highlight of my teenage years, to be pegged by an adult European as being that good a drinker, that I could drink that much and stand up. I didn't remember going to bed that night, by the way. So when I got back after that summer, somewhere through that winter, it was my 16th year, I went into the school library one day and picked up a Reader's Digest, and it had an article in it on alcoholism. And it had a set of 20 questions, very similar to what we have now. At age 16, I took that test for myself, pegged myself as an alcoholic, said, "Yeah, I guess I am." And my attitude was, "So what? So are a lot of my friends. I don't really, if this is the sort of definition of being an alcoholic, if this is what's accepted, I am, but I don't give a damn." And that would be the way I was until I was 46 years old. So I had 30 years of drinking in that period of time. I'm a weird alcoholic in another way. I only had three jobs in my entire adult life. I was never unemployed for a day. I came out of high school, started a job at a bank the next day, left the bank after a year, started in the Royal Canadian Air Force the next day, was there for 6 years, and was still on their payroll when I was discharged, and went east from where I was, and got a job at a company that I worked at for 30 years. Never a gap, but all this time my alcoholism was building up. That's where I was as I got to adult life. Teenage years, I hear so much around here right now, people drinking in school and all that sort of thing. We didn't do that, but we did on the weekends. I was my parents were not religious. My dad wanted me to go to Sunday school, so he sent me with the next door neighbor. He was taking his kids there, and I was enrolled in a Sunday school. My dad never did attend church. My mother would like to, but she didn't. And that started my religious life, if you want to call it that. I was by myself all through my religious life. I wasn't pushed by my parents or anything else. Anything I did was my own volition. So I was I was in young people's groups. I sang in the church choir. I taught Sunday school. All this went on. This was my religious upbringing, and I was sort of a Jekyll and Hyde in that period of time. Friday or Saturday night, I'd be out with the drinking gang. Sunday, I'd be sitting up in the church choir looking to see if there were any new girls in the congregation that day. And that was my religious upbringing. And I even had myself christened. I had never been christened. I had myself christened on my own volition. When I got out of high school, as I say, I worked at a bank for a year. That's a great training ground for an alcoholic, bankers. Or it was at that time, anyway. And then I joined the Royal Canadian Air Force as an officer cadet. And after a year, I was commissioned as an officer. You know, yeah, and I was in air crew for 5 years after my commissioning, and the great thing about that was that I didn't mention salaries, but when I worked at the bank, the salary at that time was $1,000 a year, $89 a month in round figures, and when I went in the Air Force, it was a much better paying job, and it increased as I went along, and I found in the Air Force I could start to drink the way I like to. There were messes to drink in, and the booze was cheap. Nobody looked down at you if you fell off the bar stool. It was an accepted procedure. Don't do that in the outer part of the mess. Fall off the stool in the back bar. Yeah, so it was accepted procedure. So my drinking progressed bit by bit. Never to the daily stage at that point. This is more of a binge drinking. One nice thing about that was I was on a squadron for 3 years, and then for 2 years I was instructing in a school, training people a little younger than me to take my job. Doesn't seem fair. That's what was going on. But I started a bit of noon hour drinking while I was instructing. We'd have a beer or two at noon before we went up in the air in the afternoon, things like that, you know. So So that was my drinking in the Air Force. I pulled an awful lot of dumb stunts drinking while I was there. I never got in serious trouble, but enough that when the time came, my 6 years was up, and I could be accepted for a permanent commission, and if it was offered, I could turn it down. I never got the opportunity to turn it down. So a rare show of intelligence on their part, they didn't give me a permanent commission. So that was, at that point I was living in Winnipeg, man, and while the squadrons I was on, I was in right from Vancouver Island to Nova Scotia in Canada, a distance of about 5,500 miles difference. So I moved around a lot, and when my time was up, I was instructing at a school in Winnipeg, Manitoba, about halfway, a couple of hundred miles north of Minneapolis, just to give you a spot on it. And here's another alcoholic thing I should bring up at this point. Just after I got my commission, I was on a base on Vancouver Island, and I went over to Vancouver for a weekend, and got invited to a party on the air base in Vancouver, and went there, got horribly drunk, and during that period, there was a gal there that I'd met when I was in training. I hadn't met her. I'd eyed her up, and she'd eyed me up, and we were both sort of drunk, and there was one free glass of booze left, and I had a longer arm than her. That was our introduction. She was being transferred from there to the base I was on the next Wednesday, and I made a date with her. And we both did. We both remembered it. That's an oddity. And I think this is alcoholic behavior. This was about the second weekend in October, and we were married in the middle of December. And that should never have worked. It lasted for 31 years. So that should never have worked. But here we were in about 5 years of marriage by this time, and I was going to be out of a job, and we were leaving this city of Winnipeg, and it was the middle of December, colder than hell. We got in the car and had no plans, and got down to the highway where you turned east or west and flipped a coin and it said to turn east. I did that, and 2 weeks later I was employed with this company that I stayed with for 30 years. So things happen to me. Things happen to me. One thing that happened was I went from a salary my last year or so in the Air Force of about $600 a month at that time down to $300. And that was my drinking money. It was gone. And I never got to the point where I got into a lot of debt to drink. But I found that after that point, I like to save up a bit of money. If I was good, I couldn't see the sense in having one drink. No sense in that at all. May as well save up enough money to tie one on. So in other words, I was sort of a binge drinking alcoholic for several years until my salary picked up as things went along. So that was going to that was in 1956, and that was going to be where I lived until 1989. And I worked for that company for 30 years, kept getting promotions. I don't know why. I shouldn't have been, and my drinking kept increasing. At a point about 8 years before I stopped drinking, I was to the point where I was drunk all day and all night on the job. I was drunk. I've sort of calculated the amount I was drinking. I was probably operating on a 0.2. That would have been my norm, 0.2. I didn't, it was at that point, about 6 or 7 years before I quit, that I started drinking on the job, or at least at noon hours, getting enough in to last me till 4 o'clock. And by the time I came to the program, my alcoholism had increased to the point where I was having my last drink about 12:30 at night and my first one about 6 o'clock in the morning, if I lasted that long. In other words, by the time I went, my morning drink was, my last drink at night was a water glass of vodka, and my first drink in the morning was another water glass of vodka. So that's the state I was in when I got here. And I was spiritually and mentally losing it, let's face it. That was that's the only way I could explain it, that I considered myself hopeless by this point, and I was looking around for a way to kill myself that wouldn't look like suicide, so my wife would get the insurance. I didn't want her left without the insurance. But that was the thinking that was going through my head at the time I came to the program. What got me here was one day I was more impaired than usual on the job, and I was out driving from one location that I had to look after to another, and the yard boss stopped to ask me a question, and when I opened the window, I guess it just about blew him over. And he reported me, and later that afternoon I was asked to report to my supervisor. Get in, as bad as I was, get in your car and drive 3 miles over to where the supervisor is. But that was the last straw. I'd been wrapped on the wrist a couple of times before that, but just enough to say I better take it easy for a day or two. So the suggestion from my employer was that I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the company I was with had an employee assistance program that included alcohol problems, and I was put on with one of those, who explained a bit about AA to me, and said, this was on a Friday, Thursday I'd been caught, and this was on the Friday, and he said he'd get me to a meeting the next Tuesday. Through sheer willpower, I didn't drink that Friday. Saturday was another story. Sunday, I had a little heel of a bottle left, and I drank that. That was on December 4th. And I didn't dare drink going to work on the Monday and Tuesday, and but I was shaking and really not worth very much, and it was sheer willpower that I hadn't drank. I had no other reason, and fear that if I lost my job, I'd lose my ability to drink what I like to drink the way I like to drink. So my intention was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 weeks. My head was telling me, your employer's going to have spies there looking at it. My employer was a multinational Canadian mining firm, and we had 27,000 employees just in the area I worked in. And he was going to worry about me and send spies to this to AA to see if I was drinking, if I was going to meetings or not. So I went to my first meeting today, on December 6, 1977. By time that would have been about 5:30 tonight that I went to my first AA meeting, and I did not want to go. I was only going for 2 weeks. I knew what I was going to find here. I was going to find a religious cult. I knew that. That was a foregone up in here. And I was going to find spies looking to see if I was there or not. That's the way I would end. I always like to give the feeling that went on in my inside me when I went, was dragged to that first meeting, that I equate what was going on inside me with being grabbed by the scruff of the neck, dragged down the 6 or 8 steps down to the basement where that church basement where that meeting was, and just not wanting to be there. And of course, I had the big bravado on. I walked down the stairs. I wouldn't have gone in on my own. This guy from work had said that he'd meet me there, and it was a cold, snowy December night. We'd had lots of snow on the weekend, and the parking lot at this big church where the meeting was hadn't been plowed properly, so I nosed my car into a snowdrift and sat there and thought, if there was a lot of cars there, I thought, boy, a lot of my neighbors must be having something going on at church here today. And I didn't want them to see me, so I was all slouched down in my seat, trying to get out of the way, and looking at my watch and saying, it was an 8:30 meeting, I was looking at my watch and saying, if he's not here by 8:30, I'll just go back home, and figure that they didn't really want me here. You know, great, great thinking up here. And sure enough, about 25 after 8, a fellow came around, not the one I was expecting, looking in the cars, and he sees this poor soul all slumped down in his seat, and tells me who he is, and we use the back door over here, and I go in there, and not thinking I was going to see very many people, and there was about 60 people at that meeting, and it scared the hell out of me to see all those people. He sat me down, and the meeting was just about ready to start. He sat me down and got me a coffee, which I promptly spread all over the table, and because I tried to pick it up and it didn't want to come. That was my first meeting. The things I remember about it was that I did listen. I knew it was a religious cult right away because they had some of the little sayings here up on the stage at the church, and the only one I could see was "Let go, let God." couldn't see any of the others. But yeah, I'm right. That's what this is. I sat there through that meeting and didn't stay around after. Nobody grabbed me, and I got out of there as fast as I could and went home. And my wife said, "Well, how was it?" I said, "Well, I'm right. It's a religious cult." So. But I didn't know there was any other meetings in town. So a week later, not having had anything to drink in that period of time, I went to my second meeting. And this time, I wasn't shaking quite as bad by then. As a week had gone by, I wasn't shaking quite as bad. Somebody put a directory, gave me a directory. There was 43 other meetings in that city at that time, and I thought this was the only one. I was scared to death going into the meetings. How would I put it? I just the second time I about after about four, 3 or 4 weeks of going to one a week, I tried to go to another one. And I drove around the block until after 8:30 and then thought, well, I can't go in there late, so I better go home. that's how this old head was working then. But this is for newer people in here, this feeling. But when I walked into that AA meeting, or was dragged in as I felt I was being, something terrible happened to me. Really, really terrible. I lost the compulsion to drink immediately. I went home that night and didn't have the terrible compulsion to have the drink before I went to bed. Like that compulsion had been there even though I hadn't used it for a couple of nights. I lost it. When I got up the next morning, that compulsion wasn't there. It has never, ever returned. Now, you might say, isn't that wonderful? No, it's not. For anybody new here, no, it's not. because what that said to me as I started coming to more meetings and getting more involved in AA was, I've been cured. I read this book and it says here are some suggestions, but I don't have to do those because I'm already not drinking. I don't even want to drink. Why should I do those things? And this feeling lasted for 7 years. I never did, because of my feeling on religion, I felt there was only about four of them I could do anyway, so I did them. And the rest, I thought they're only suggestions, and I've been cured. I don't have the compulsion to drink. And, I really do look on it as a terrible thing to happen to anyone. That far better you come in and have a real fight getting rid of that compulsion than to have it taken away immediately and have a head like mine that says, hey, I don't have to do anything here now. But that's the way my first 7 years in AA went. It wasn't that I sat around doing nothing. I got involved with I joined a group, the one I went to the first meeting at. I joined that group. And it's a little different where I came from. You actually had your name put on a piece of, on a list, and you were a member of that group. And you were expected to be there every meeting night, which was once a week. You could go to all the meetings you wanted, but that was your home group. And I didn't do very much there for a while, and God, I better get going here. And as time went on, I was my head was screwed up so bad that they didn't give chips every couple of or every week or anything like that. The first one you got was for 3 months. And when my 3 months came up, I went to the meeting that night. It was a speaker meeting on their chip night. It was a speaker meeting. And they didn't announce my name, and I didn't get up and say, hey, you forgot me. I just said, well, hell. And I'm going up the stairs after, and one fella says to another ahead of me, who was the guy that was supposed to get the 3 month chip? And the guy says, I don't know. Who are you? He said, was he here? He says, yeah, he's here. He said, God, he must be a real asshole. I went home with that resentment in me. And the other thing was that chip night was usually a little party night after. People bring sandwiches and all that. I hadn't stayed around for any of that. This asshole didn't stay around for that. People brought their wives. People brought their wives, and it was just a nice, homey feeling. And I got used to this idea that AA was a selfish program by that time. And I was selfish. I wasn't going to bring my wife. So I didn't get my three-month chip, which was actually three and a half months I'd been in by then. The next month, 4.5 months, I took my wife to the meeting, brought some sandwiches, and got my chip. So that was the change that came over me in that period of time. I got to speed things up here a bit now. So I've got to the point that I really wanted to get across, that you really have to work this program. I got a sponsor, by the way. I picked one out after considerable nagging from my group, and I picked a dandy. I saw a fellow there that I liked what he had to say at the meetings, but I knew if I didn't phone him, he wouldn't phone me. 5 years later, I still hadn't phoned him, and he hadn't phoned me. But we did see one another at meetings. That was as far as I got on sponsorship. Why should this ever happen to me? You know, this should never be. When I'd been in for 7 years, a little over 6 years, that wife that I married in 2 weeks passed away with cancer. I still didn't have a higher power. my group was my higher power, and really that didn't work, did it? And I asked for one thing when I'd started to get some inclinations here, and I asked for one thing when she was so sick, not that she be cured, because that was, she was terminal, but I asked that she not suffer too much. And over the last 6 or 8 months, about a 2 Tylenol day was a bad day. And it took me about a year after she'd passed away to understand that something had happened there, that somebody had listened to me. And I finally was able to get a higher power at that point that I could understand. I had thrown God out of my life while I was in the Air Force, even. I wasn't mad at him. I just didn't believe any of the things I'd been told. And had thrown God out. So I got a higher power I could understand, and picked up a new sponsor who I still have. He's 3,000 miles away. I've never had a sponsor here. I've kept the one 3,000 miles away all this time. We see one another once in a while. We talk often. Talk to him today. I'm just trying to piece things together here. From there on, I started doing the things I should have done on day one in the program, doing the steps as is indicated, as is suggested, realizing that that's no suggestion. That's a way of having success. And I got active in my group, started out shaking hands, and then setting up tables. I say we had 60 people at a, we only had 20 in the group, but 60 people at meetings, setting up tables, things like that. I was secretary of it for a while. I was a GSR. I was a secretary of the district. This was all in that five and a half, six year period when I had done nothing. I did a lot of 12-step calling, but I had not done what I was supposed to do. But that seemed to keep me on the growing. Somehow or other, that kept me growing in this period of time. After my wife had died, 2 years later, we had a decent-sized house with an in-ground swimming pool in it and all this sort of thing in that cold country, I wasn't enjoying the house anymore, and it was full of old furniture that had been in my wife's family since the 1900s, real old stuff. And I didn't know how to get rid of that and sell the house. I felt obligated to keep that and whatnot. And so I went to visit my wife, my mother, 2,000 miles west. I drove out in the middle of December to see her. And on the way there, I got talking to this higher power that I'd finally been able to start to formulate. And I said, you know, I'd really like some help on how to handle this house problem. And I don't know if I got an answer from him or not. But while I was there over Christmas, a week after New Year's, the phone rang one morning, my neighbor telling me my house burnt down. And I like to say my higher power solved my problem, but he burnt my house down. So all of that sounds bad, my wife dying, the house burning down. I'd been offered a pension before I went on that vacation. I never ever went back to work. I took the pension at that point. I've been happily pensioned ever since. I just like to think that I would never be down here now if that house hadn't burnt down. Let's put it that way. And what happened when I got here? I met a widow, my stepdaughter's mother, at the Alano Club in Solvang. And this sounds like two alcoholics getting together. We met in March and got married in August. So A little longer, a couple of months longer. We were married very happily for 15 years. She passed away, as Kathy said, 10 and a half years ago now, very suddenly. But I would not be here today if it wasn't for all this stuff, bad things happening in my life. So out of every bad thing, something good seems to happen, at least for this alcoholic. And I just sort of, how many coincidences can there be? Where should we start? That reaching for that glass of booze, flipping that coin. I missed the real debt. Can I take about 2 seconds to say? Yeah. Just to tell you how I got rid of my the God in my life. When I was in the Air Force, I was a crew member on a Lancaster bomber, and we were at the end of August. We were up flying way well north of very high up in the Arctic in Canada. Russia had just exploded its first hydrogen bomb, and we were flying around in the fallout cloud. We had left where we were going at 5:30 at night, got away up there and flew around, and 2:30 in the morning we were heading back to a base on Hudson Bay, on an air base at Hudson Bay, and somewhere along the way we'd been in clouds all day and hadn't been able to get a good fix of where we were or anything. To make a long story short, a slight amount of pilot error flew us into the ground. And we bounced and we exploded, ended up in a lake, sort of the way that passenger plane ended up in the river in New York, tail first, came down. It was burning and whatnot. We got out of that and swam around in this lake in the Arctic for about an hour till the fire went out. And the plane didn't completely go down. It sank to the bottom, but there was about a foot of aircraft left above. Spent a night on there. Saw where we were in the morning. It was about half a mile from shore. Managed to get to shore, and we lived there for a week before we were found. And it was terrible weather for any kind of search to go on, and about the fourth night we had a little fire ready in case something came by at night that we could light a fire in a hurry. It was my turn to sit around the fire, and I sat there and I was thinking, you know, all this time, this had been going on for several couple of years in my thinking, that I never ever believed what I'd been told in church. And I thought, the chances of getting out of here are pretty slim. Eight people, about the only eight human beings in 40, 50, 100,000 square miles, the chances of getting out of there are pretty slim. And I had no beef with God or anything like that. I just decided I did not believe that. And I left God out of my life at that point, never to return. And that was, I just wanted to sort of fill you in on how I felt when I got here about, and why I thought this was a religious program to start with. So that was pretty well where I was at that point. I was going to say, how many coincidences can there be? And I say the flipping the coin, picking that glass up, that air being found up there. Here's the clincher. The day we were found, about mid-afternoon on a Saturday, and we crashed about 3 o'clock in the morning the previous Sunday. The sun finally came out. Way off in the horizon was a search aircraft that would never have seen us. We had a mirror with us, and we saw in the mirror of the aircraft, and he saw that, and that's how we were found. So there's another coincidence. The sun came out just for the first time in 6 days. My house burnt down. Was that a coincidence? I don't think so. I don't think so. just so many things have happened in my life that in my thinking now, I realize my higher power, who I finally found, had been with me all my life, whether I believed or didn't believe or what I was doing, my higher power was with me. There, if I had needed the help and had asked for it, I would have got it. Thanks, folks.
Thank you, Bill. Let's give Bill another round of applause. At this meeting, we have a big book raffle. Jacob is going to go around to so he'll come up here and...